pride's the greatest sin. I got to be the biggest sinner in the world. When I got in the business, I started out living in a house trailer and living on about $50 a week with my wife and kids, and followed everything back. Why was I doing that? To sell more pizzas, make more money. Why? Because I wanted more than anybody else. And I said, that's an ugly person. And I just, right on the spot, I said, I'm going to give up all ostentatious luxuries. I'm going to get rid of all the planes, the boats, the lodge, the car collection, and everything. And so I did. I called it Millionaire's Bob of Poverty. And my wife had a Jaguar and a Cadillac. I bought her. I said, honey, maybe you might want to get a Buick or a Mercury or something. So you took the vow. I didn't.
Are you looking for a comfortable brown scapular that won't break? Check out our sponsor, scapulars.com. Hello, and thanks for being with us here on A Reason for Hope podcast. Been very grateful of the many years that we've been doing this for you. This is our sixth season with hundreds of podcasts already released. Although they're free to watch and listen to, they're not free to produce. So I'm asking that you discern to contributing and donate to A Reason for Hope podcast. We're a nonprofit organization. Every dollar, every penny is tax deductible. All you have to do is go to our website and click donation and navigate the podcast. All the funds that you donate will go to the production of this podcast. Thanks again, and may God bless you. They use American-made paracord, so it's super strong. And they also use Australian merino wool, so it's super comfortable. It feels like you're getting a warm hug from your heavenly mother. Click on the link above or below in the description and get yourself the most durable, comfortable scapulars in the world.
Ave Maria Mutual Funds, seeking the moral high ground for 20 years. Pro-life, pro-family, and Catholic values have guided us to the top.
Hey, thanks for joining us today on Our Reason for Hope. I just found out the other day from one of our producers that, you know, more than half the people that watch this show, this podcast, do not subscribe to us. This is insane. I mean, what are you waiting for? Hit the subscribe button now. All right, back to the show. Hello and welcome back to A Reason for Hope. I'm your host, Mario Costabile, and I am super excited that you're joining us today. And today's podcast is a very special one. I had the opportunity to interview Thomas Monahan, who is a legend in the Catholic space. We spent some time talking about his life, from his humble beginnings when he was in an orphanage to when he joined the Marines, and then when he started Domino's without any money. What a success story. Really just learning how, through many difficulties, he persevered and how his faith was always part of his life. A true inspiration to all of us, his growth as a Christian and how he recognized the importance of God along the way. Although God was always important in his life, he recognized how important it was to be humble, to share the faith, and also to evangelize the faith. So I'm very excited to present this interview to you all today. So let's get to it. So Tom, thank you so much for saying yes for this interview.
That's a great thing you do.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You know, you're an inspiration for all of us, especially me. And I'm excited to just go a little bit deeper into your life, know a little bit about what inspired you to do what you do. One of the things I discovered when I was doing a little research and finding out about you, I didn't realize, well, you had a difficult upbringing in the sense that your dad passed away very young, right? Mm-hmm. On Christmas Eve, was it? You know, yes. When you were four? You know, maybe you could share, you know, I mean, I know that it must have been very tragic when you were young, but what did that feel like, you know, at such a young age?
Well, we were very poor. And it was still in the Depression, 1937. And my dad apparently had some health problems with his stomach. He ended up dying of ulcers. They didn't have penicillin then, so it was terminal. And my, I have fond memories of my dad. He died on Christmas Eve, 1941. I remember being at the funeral home, and they were apparently trying to keep me away from him, but I saw him in the casket from a distance. I ran up to him, and I said, "Daddy, wake up, wake up, wake up." I just couldn't accept it that he died.
And after that period, you ended up going in foster homes, you and your brother,
died,
right?
I lived in a foster home for about a year and a half. With my brother. He was 2.5 years younger than I was. And then my mother put us at a Catholic orphanage. It was close to, closer to where she worked. She, after my dad died, she went back to nursing school and became a nurse. So the orphanage was about 5-6 blocks from the hospital she worked at in Jackson, Michigan. And I saw a letter later to my aunt saying that I would move them to this orphanage because they're Catholic, and Tommy, it's me, will be able to go to a Catholic school, and it's going to save me $1 a week. I think she's paying $7, bring it down to $6, so for two kids, that's $2 a week. A lot of money back then.
Yeah.
So I discovered that letter. It was very sentimental.
There was a sister, a nun, that was very influential in your life at that point. I think she was, she at the orphanage or was she at school?
No, she was at the orphanage. Well, the school and the orphanage were the same.
Okay.
We had school right there. It was about 50 boys, and in my grade there was about 6. And then the room, we had 3 grades, there was probably about 15 or 20. And I had been to half of the first grade in a public school. And I didn't do very well. And here I flourished. I was, I seemed to be ahead of the kids that were in the grade or two ahead of me. In fact, she suggested I skip the third grade and go to the fourth. But my mother wouldn't let me, so I was kind of disappointed. But, so I flourished under her. She just thought I could do anything.
And what was her name?
Sister Barada. She was a very young sister, Polish. English was second language. And she just thought I could. I remember one time in class, they asked us what we wanted to be when we grew up. I said, I want to play shortstop for the Detroit Tigers. I want to be a priest, and I want to be an architect. And the kids laughed, and sister said, "Well, Tommy, if there's no reason why you can't do that, if you want to, you can do it." And so that kind of encouragement.
So she was really a mentor in a sense. She really gave you a lot of direction. What an amazing gift you had when you were a young boy.
Yeah, I owe my faith to her. Yeah, as well as my whatever confidence I have. I
think. Mm-hmm. And there was also another influential person in your life, a priest in high school that really helped you formulate.
I got the orphanage at 12, and that was the 7th grade. And I went from incredible strictness to total freedom. No, my mother worked nights, so I could do anything I want, you know, and get away with it. But he kind of took me under his wing, and he gave me jobs around the school, and he told me to be good to my mother and everything. And I never really had that much experience with a man. And so I really admired him. I believe it was the reason I went to the seminary.
I wanted to just ask you, so you said it was very strict, which, tell me a little bit about that. How was, you know, that sister, that nun, how was she, how did she form you in with discipline and being strict with you?
Well, I couldn't keep her all 6 years. I moved up to a different age group. Mm-hmm. Sister Ladislaus was as tough as any of the drill instructors I had in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. So that was a different story. She was holy, but she was tough. And She had to be with boys that age. And, and I couldn't wait till I got out. I mean, I just get out and be out in the world with everybody else.
But I'm sure those rules and regulations and those parameter really made you understand, you know, the truth, because she was really probably pretty strict about that.
Oh, yes. And I was, it was incredible amount of spirituality. I mean, we went to Mass every day. We had communion every day.
Wow.
And long morning prayers, long evening prayers. Everything was God and Jesus and the church. And I really bought into that.
So you mentioned, you know, the Marines, the Marine Corps. So where did that happen in your chronology of your life?
When I graduated from high school, I'm on my own, supporting myself. No hope to go to college because I didn't crack a book the last couple of years. And then I was floundering, working a lot of hours, playing ping pong every night because I loved ping pong. And it's getting nowhere. Then I decided that I better make something of my life. So I applied for a school that anybody could get into. It's a brand new state school. And I got in and I got good grades. I went there for a quarter. They're on the quarter system. And from that, I got accepted at the University of Michigan, where I could be an architect. But I didn't have the money for Michigan. So I hitchhiked to Chicago to look for a job, because I couldn't find anything around Ann Arbor, Detroit. And I couldn't find anything. And I'm walking by the post office in Harvey, Illinois, suburb of Chicago, and I had seen ads, there were the Army ads said, if you join the Army, they'll pay for your college. I said, well, let's see about that. So there was a recruiting poster in the window of the post office. So I went in. I said, is that true? If I join the Army, you pay for my college? He said, yeah. Said, if you join for 3 years, you get, and I didn't have to worry about the draft because I had hearing problems. But he said, if you join the Army, if you join for 3 years, you get 2 years of college all paid for. I said, would that be good in Michigan? He said, oh, yeah, no problem. So I went down to the federal building in Chicago, filled all the papers and everything, and then I found out that that guy was in the Army. He was a Marine. And so it wasn't until I signed the papers, I saw the Globe and Anchor in the corner. And I thought all the branches were there, because there's hundreds of men there going through the physicals.
Mm-hmm.
My physical, they checked my ears. They looked one and one the other. I didn't say anything. So I figured, what's the difference? And I asked the guy next to me, is this the Army or the Marine Corps? This is the Marine Corps. Yet. So I said, what's the difference? Signed it. And there it was. And it was the biggest shock you can imagine. And
but I'm sure it gave you the art of discipline and focus, right?
It was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I had the second highest score in my outfit. So I thought I was going to get some special school at least or something. They put me in the infantry. And that's the best thing. That's the best schooling you can get.
How so?
It's just discipline. Taking hardships that you never thought you could do. Hiking for hours and hours with a full pack in the boondocks of Okinawa, sleeping in a pup tent, and then you're 3 weeks out in the field, and then you come into the barracks for a week, and you got to spend your whole week cleaning up for all the inspections and everything, and all the stress of that. It was
good learning ground.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Hello, and thanks for being with us here on A Reason for Hope podcast. Been very grateful of the many years that we've been doing this for you. This is our sixth season with hundreds of podcasts already released. Although they're free to watch and listen to, they're not free to produce. So I'm asking that you discern to contributing and donate to A Reason for Hope podcast. We're a nonprofit organization. Every dollar, every penny is tax deductible. All you have to do is go to our website and click donation and navigate the podcast. All the funds that you donate will go to the production of this podcast. Thanks again, and may God bless you.
So let's jump ahead a little bit. So Thomas Monahan, I mean, that's not Italian, right?
No. You want to get to pizza?
I want to get to the pizza. I'm trying to make the connection. How did that happen?
Well, let me get back to one other thing, if
okay.
I may.
Okay.
One of the things that happened when in the Marine Corps, I'm stuck here. I got to make the best of it. So I can do what I did. I was always a big dreamer, a lot of ambition. And so I'm while the other kids are going out and getting drunk and getting tattooed and everything, I'm going to the library. I'm working out in the gym. And there was a board ship coming back, and we had a rudder problem. So we're out there a long time, nothing to do. And I'm sitting there dreaming in my bunk of all the things I'm going to do when I get out, all the things I'm going to have, all the success and everything. And all of a sudden I realized, so what? Is that going to make me happy? And I said, well, what is important? What will make me happy? What's important? So and I went through a process that's probably the clearest thinking I ever had in my life. I probably had to be out in the middle of the Pacific to be able to do this. And I realized that if I had all the money in the world, if I lost my health, I'd give a lot to get it back. And so my health was more important than my pocketbook. And I thought, well, if I ever had the body of a Greek god and had nothing between my ears, I'd be better off with a paraplegic in a wheelchair with a sound mind, great attitude. So my mental and emotional health is more important than my physical health. And then I said, well, but I have all that, but I got to have friends and relationships. So that's more important than I have friends, relationships, particularly family. So that's more important. So now I'm getting somewhere. I got a formula for life. There's one thing. I'm going to die. And I'm either going to go to heaven or I'm going to go to hell. And hell is worse than anything I imagine. Heaven's greater than anything I can imagine. And so I figure, well, and if it's not true, living to work towards heaven is a much happier way to live than just getting all the enjoyment you can squeeze out of life. And if it is true, you hit the jackpot if you live following the commandments there. So that, just like the light went off. Spiritual, social, mental, physical, and financial. But it had to be in that order. I found out years later that Socrates had the four ingredients for happiness. It was learning, friends, health, and wealth. He had four of the five. He didn't have the most important one. And he didn't have them in order. So that from there on, all of a sudden I had a self-image. All of a sudden I was a success because I knew what I had to do and I was going to do it. And I've succeeded at the bottom too. I'm still working on the other one.
It's a great story. I mean, you at an early age, you were able to model really a roadmap for your life, mm-hmm. which is really what a grace that was.
Yeah. All of a sudden I had the formula for everything.
And you had it in the right order, putting God first, which was amazing at such a young age. Usually takes a lifetime to figure that out.
I have a sister, brother, and father passed now. I mean, work for that. I wouldn't even have my faith.
Beautiful. So, and thank you for that. So tell me how, you know, you got to flipping pizzas.
Well, I got out of the Marine Corps. I saved most of my money that I made for college just before I got out of it. Because I was still accepted to Michigan. I remember met an oil man hitchhiking back to the base. And he ended up getting my 3 years of savings in the Marine Corps. He was a con man, a very smooth talker. And so I got out of the Marine Corps broke. I got several jobs, applied to Michigan. Didn't have enough money for textbooks. So I dropped out, worked more hours trying to save money. And I went back next semester, and I'm working so much I can't stay awake in class, so I drop out again. And I'm 24 years old, and I'm still a freshman. And I'm, you know, like, what happened to me? And then my brother was a mailman in Ann Arbor, and he, on his route, was a pizza place. Got to know the guy. He stopped there for lunch. And he happened to have a place in Ypsilanti, which is near Ann Arbor. The place that he built that never got off the ground and that was closed. And he tried to talk my brother into buying it, $500 down. And I never knew what the balance was. And and he tried to talk me into doing it. I said, I don't know anything about the pizza business. He says, well, I've worked at a pizza place before, and there's nothing to it. Okay, so I found out later he worked in a place for a month and all he did was wash dishes. So I said, okay, well, this is what I'll do. We'll go on this as a partner. It's only open at night. I work half a night. He work half a night. I have plenty of time to go to school, and we'll make money selling pizza so I can pay for it. And that's what we did, $500 down, which we borrowed from a credit union. And then after we signed the papers, my brother got cold feet. Couldn't give up the security of his post office job. So I was stuck there, running it myself. There goes college. And I'm working 7 days a week, losing money, trying to figure out how to make this work. And one day I told my brother, you got to give me a night off. You know, you own half of this place. So I came and worked one night. I took night off, came in the next night. He came in to visit me, and he said, I want out. This isn't for me. He said, you can just have it. You don't have to pay me anything. I said, well, it's not worth anything. All we got is bills and debt. But you should give you something because, you know, you took a risk. But I don't have anything. We just bought a used Volkswagen, I think $50 down for a delivery car. And I said, Jim, you take the delivery car, and I'll make the payments on it. That's how I bought out 50% of the largest pizza chain in the world.
Wow.
And you got the better part of the deal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But you got the idea to deliver pizza, right?
Yes.
That was a unique, no one was doing that at that time.
Oh, yeah. Well, in Ann Arbor, it was one of those unique places that was a major college town. And they had pizza and they had delivery. And I was a customer before I got them. And it was free delivery. In order to have a business, you had to deliver.
Oh, okay.
You had two tables, eight chairs. I ended up falling in love with delivery because it was something that was impossible. Nobody ever made any money delivering pizzas if they had more than one unit. It's just multi-units, just impossible. It's too many difficulties, the help situation, the kind of help you can get, the late hours and, accidents and robberies. So I said, if I can figure this out, I'll be all right. And so I was the first one to really focus on delivery. I got rid of the tables. I narrowed the menu down to just pizza and Coke. Because all your business and delivery comes up once. Because people don't know you're busy. They just pick up the phone. The weather's bad or something. The concert gets out on campus. They don't know you're busy. But you got to figure out how to handle that. The competition's just going to pull the phones because they can't handle it. I was going to figure out how to handle that. And that was a real challenge to handle the peak periods. And that's what I did time and motion studies. I did all kinds of things to simplify the menu. At the same time, try to make the quality better. Just quality and handle the rush. And that's what I did. That first place became the busiest pizzeria in the world. And it's not a big market. Small school, small town.
Really?
Doing about 6,000 pizzas a week. Only open at night.
Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed with contrarian thinking. Their independent research and analysis provide a deep understanding of our investments with the intent to avoid or minimize unpleasant surprises. This helps to ensure that their funds' investments match your moral beliefs. The advisor invests in securities only if they meet the fund's investment and religious requirements, and as such, the return may be lower or higher than if the advisor made decisions solely based on investment considerations. The fund's method of security selection may or may not be successful, and the fund may underperform or outperform the stock market as a whole. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. For a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, charges, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, call 1-866-AVE-MARIA. That's 1-866-283-6274, or visit the link above or below in the description. The Brown Scapular is a special Catholic devotional. Invest in a scapular that is as strong as your devotion. At scapulars.com, they use super strong American-made paracord because your scapular should be as strong as your devotion. They also use the finest Australian merino wool that feels like a warm hug from your heavenly mother. You'll also find handmade rosaries with our distinctive deliverance cross, Italian-made saint medals, keychains, and jewelry. Visit the link above or below in the description to get yourself one of the most durable, comfortable scapulars in the world.
You kind of honed in on a specific idea and really said, this is where small menu, find out ways to get people to deliver those pizzas and handle the demand. And that was your secret.
Yeah. And I would take a day off once in a while and go around in the Midwest and visit pizza places because I wanted to learn everything I could about the business. And I was just obsessed with learning. I certainly became more knowledgeable about the pizza than anybody in the world. Every part of it, the dough, the cheese, the sauce. I put together a panel of blind people to taste test the sauces and everything.
So you became part Italian. tasting the sauces.
Well, it's easy to compete with you Italians because the Italians...
Food is everything for us.
They didn't report all their sales.
That's right. Everything's under the table. You didn't learn that part.
No, I reported. I was one of the few people in the cash business that was dumb enough to report all my sales.
Well, it served you well, though. You know. At some point in time, you got the idea to franchise, right? To mm-hmm. expand. So that must have been like exciting and a whole nother way to look at business.
Yeah, well, I had the store, the original store in Ypsilanti, one in Ann Arbor, one in East Lansing, probably the three busiest pizzerias in the world. And I had some other stores around them to cover the outlying area so the campus store could concentrate on campus, get better service. And I decided I might franchise those neighborhood stores. And then I set up Central Kitchen so we can make the dough and ship it to the stores every day, make the sauce, slice the pepperoni, grind the cheese, the vegetables and everything, so that the store could concentrate on handling the rush and at the same time have a lot better quality in the stores because everything's uniform. And I used to go to the franchise seminars at Boston College, and all the big names were there, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Burger King, and all the rest of them. And I see these guys in the Rolls Royces and Ray Kroc at McDonald's.
Did you pull up at the Volkswagen?
I had sold that. Oh. And so I decided maybe the way to go is franchise. And I would concentrate on only campus stores and franchise the rest of them. And I decided what I have to do is go public. And so I talked to a broker in Detroit. He said, you gotta get out of the seat of the pants operation you have and get more professional. You gotta look better. You gotta get rid of that one man bookkeeper and get a CPA firm. You gotta get an attorney and switch to an attorney in Detroit. You gotta get computerized. You gotta do this and you gotta do that. And so I did all those things. And the whole thing fell apart.
Really?
Yeah.
So
I lost control of the company. The bank brought in somebody and they were given 51%. And I was way behind my withholding taxes, and that's pretty serious stuff. The people that came in said they'd cover the withholding taxes if they had to. And that was all I got for 51% of the business. And That's why I was still there running it under their direction, which was miserable because they milked the franchisees and raised the prices in the commissary, lowered the quality of the products. And the franchisees got upset. They filed a class action antitrust suit against the company. We only had about 30 stores. You're not supposed to have that until you get hundreds of stores. And so they built the company and gave it back to me. I worked my way out of this litigation with franchisees one store at a time, and then gradually built. I had hundreds of creditors I couldn't pay, and I just figuring worked every day, just figuring this might be my last day. Three creditors could put me in the, out of the business. And so thank God that they organized, creditors organized a big meeting with the attorneys and everything, because this guy is living like a king on their money. And one of the accountants who had been in my house, one of the big creditors, and he said, they're talking about me living like a king and all this money I'm bringing in and on their money. And he said, I've been in this house. He didn't have any furniture. And that changed the whole tenor of it.
Wow.
And they worked with me. And I got to a point where I could pay every place. I got a lot of lawsuits. And I couldn't afford an attorney, so I just defended myself. And I got to know the judge real well. I told him, I said, I can't pay anybody now, but I'll pay everybody when I can. I don't care how long it takes. And he did that. So some of these people, they made settlements on, on 10 cents of the dollar, paying $10 a month forever, things like that. But the ones that didn't force me into that, I paid every penny of it back. And I sent out a letter. I had a special checks printed up with me wearing a barrel. And I called it Operation Surprise.
Wow.
I sent out the first check to everybody with a letter saying that I hope this will continue until I pay you off, pay you every penny. And that was the best thing I ever did, because they all, most have written it off.
Yes. So, I mean, basically what that says to me loud and clear is that honesty, integrity is the foundation of a businessman, because they probably sensed that and they trusted you after you saw how hard you worked.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was working 7-8 living.
And you believed in the product and you stand by what your word. And I think today a lot of people, a lot of businessmen, were not like that, you know? And so that's a great example of your story there. And then eventually it became what it became, right? And became extremely successful once you got out of that.
And eventually you could.
Eventually.
A long word. It took a long time.
Eventually, yeah. Many, many years.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the experience that you receive, the resilience and adapting is, that's part of your success is being able to call audibles and to switch on a dime. And that's the mark of, you know, seeing where the problems are and adjusting and keeping your heart pure. That's what I'm getting from what you're telling.
I had the confidence that I could do well in delivering pieces.
You believed in yourself.
I believe, and I've shown myself I could do it. I just got to quit making all these dumb mistakes with partners and everything.
But no mistake is a bad mistake if you learn by it, right? I mean, if you didn't have
those mistakes. If it doesn't kill you.
If it doesn't kill you. But I'm just saying, if you didn't have those mistakes, you probably wouldn't have had the success you had, right? Because you adapted, you learned, you know what not to do again. I mean, my father always used to say to me, you know, if you make the first mistake is okay. If you make the second mistake, well, you're just stupid if you make the same mistake again. Right, so you learn by your mistakes.
Well, I'm the world's champion at making mistakes. Nobody made more mistakes. I was so naive. I had to learn everything the hard way. I trusted people too much. And one of the things, I was a sucker for knowledge and talent. And I sometimes overlooked character. And that was always a mistake.
Mm. Well, it reveals your heart, though. You trust people. And we're going to talk about God in just a minute.
Yeah, we'll never know how much I benefit from trusting people.
I want to just shift gears a little bit. So you mentioned a bit earlier that, you know, you wanted to play for the Tigers. And then years later, so how did that all happen? How did that present itself? And You know, you buying, you know, the Tigers and then winning the World Series the very year you purchased the team?
Well, when things started going well, I started thinking about, you know, I'd really like to buy the Tigers. The owner was very old. And in baseball, you could only sell to somebody in the market of that team. They couldn't sell to somebody from New York or somewhere else.
So they have
so
to be.
So it was limited. And I'm looking at who's out there. And there weren't that many in Michigan because they were having some down times in those years. And I was at a seminar at YPO in New York, and Fred Wilpon was a speaker. He had just bought the Mets. And he told how the big difference it was after he bought them. He says, we were big in our business, but still, if I had an hour meeting with somebody, I had to spend 55 minutes establishing my credentials. And then maybe I get 5 minutes to make a sale. He said, after I bought the Mets, we spent 55 minutes to ask me questions about what's Steinbrenner like, what's like the team and this player, that player. And then the last 5 minutes say, where do I sign? And, right away I said, I got a justification for buying the Tigers. It's going to help put us on the map because we're trying to spread all over the country and nobody heard of us except for the college towns. And we weren't well known nationally because we were private. I couldn't get an interview with Fortune or Forbes if I tried. I just couldn't do it because they're not interested in a private company. This would give me that credibility. And it did. I bought Tigers in 84 and 85. We opened 3 stores a day, the most stores ever opened by a restaurant chain in history. Because all of a sudden, we're trying to get a lease somewhere. You got 5 or 6 people I'm competing with. Oh, that's a guy that owns the Detroit Tigers. They never heard of Domino's, but they heard of the Tigers.
So that must have been really exciting to own your childhood dream team.
Yeah, just 2 or 3 years before that, I was hanging by a thread.
How long did you own the Tigers for?
9 years.
Wow.
And when I bought the Tigers, I met Sparky Anderson, our manager. By the way, he was a good Catholic. Mm-hmm. He converted when he was 16 years old. And I said, Sparky, you know, when I was a kid in the orphanage, I used to play shortstop. In fact, I know that guy in infield with a ski on, without a ski on, he used to call me Monahansky. and I said, I always dreamed that someday I'd play shortstop for the Detroit Tigers. Sparky says, I love my mother, but she ain't going to pitch for me.
And you were 47?
Well, I turned 48 during that.
Wow.
After a ball.
Wow. Wow. You hit the jackpot there.
Yeah. And the sole owner in many of those. And that's when baseball was by far the most valuable franchise.
I just want to switch gears a little bit. I know that you're a very adamant, prolific reader. You read a lot. And there was a book by C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, that really impacted you. Maybe you could share that book, how it altered your life, and why you feel such a strong book to read.
Well, I was never a big fan of C.S. Lewis because he wasn't Catholic.
That's right.
And I read a book by Denise D'Souza on all the Catholic classics, Chesterton and Thomas A. Kempis, and I read them all. I finally read that one. And there was a chapter on pride. They call it the great sin. I always knew pride was the greatest of all sins. And I always tried to be humble. Always wanted to impress people, but tried to look like I wasn't trying. And he made me realize that I got to be, if pride's the greatest sin, I got to be the biggest sinner in the world. Because by this time, I'm buying all the toys, the planes, the cars, the best clothes, traveling all over the world, the best hotels. I couldn't sleep that night. I thought about my life when I was a kid. I loved sports. I wasn't that good, but I loved to play. I was aggressive. I hustled. And I risk my neck to make a great play. Well, I said, why did I do that? I said, because I wanted someone to say, great play, Tom. And then when I got into business, I started out living in a house trailer and living on about $50 a week with my wife and kids, and followed everything back. Why was I doing that? To sell more pieces, make more money. Why? Because I wanted more than anybody else. I want to sell more pieces than anybody, make more money, and have more luxuries. And I said, that's an ugly person. And I just, right on the spot, I said, I'm going to give up all ostentatious luxuries. I'm going to get rid of all the planes, the boats, the lodges, the car collection, and everything. And I'm going to just, I'm not going to give up comforts, but I'm going to give up inconvenience. I'm going to give up luxuries. And so I did. I called it Millionaire's Vow of Poverty. And my wife had a Jaguar and a Cadillac. I bought her. I said, honey, maybe you might want to get a Buick or a Mercury or something. She said, you took the vow. I didn't.
Wow.
So it was a great sense of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Those are shoes I bought 40 years ago. This is a coat I bought, I think, in 1980, in the 80s.
That's the sin of pride is something that most don't recognize, the power that the devil has over us by allowing our vanity, our humility, to take over, right?
Yeah. And well, I was kidding myself. I mean, I was going to Mass every day, saying at least three rosaries every day, reading all kinds of spiritual books, the Bible. And so I was on one side, and I think I was trying to be a billionaire saint. And on the other side, I was justifying all these things. I always had a justification. Planes, you know, save time, saves money. My time's worth a lot. The yachts, I use them for incentives for franchisees, but really for me. Same with the lodge, the car collection. You know, car collection is good publicity because I'm in the delivery business, and that's cars, and I've always loved cars. But so I always had a justification, and they're an investment. So I was walking a tightrope,
mm-hmm.
and I was, the problem is that rope was getting thinner and thinner.
Yeah, there was you recognize the hypocrisy somewhere,
yeah.
Right? You recognize.
Yeah, I was the world's biggest show off. I was just everything I didn't want to be, just the very thing I disliked in other people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was someone who was the devil, I'm sure.
But that's a powerful grace that you received. I mean, one of the things I pray for every day is, Lord, let me recognize my own sin when I'm sinning. Mm-hmm. And those are graces, right? Those are graces that God gives us. And, you know, he really showed favor on you in a multiple of areas to give you the fortitude, the drive, the discipline to do what you're doing with the church, which is where I want to kind of move our conversation into now. I know that you've, I guess, that sister instilled with you becoming a daily communicant. You went to daily Mass but you seem to have continued doing that your entire life. Why is that so important?
Well, no, I didn't. I always went to daily Mass, but there's two things I can claim, and after that I can't claim anything else.
Mm-hmm.
One is I never took the name of God in vain. As much as I swore in the Marine Corps, and I went to the Marine Corps, I never swore. And I never missed Mass on Sunday, except about six times in the Marine Corps. But no matter what, I would make Mass, except for those. I just, one morning, I just couldn't get out of the bunk. And I kept protracting. Finally, it was just too late.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next time, so easier. Then I got my act together, and I never missed Mass on Sunday since, or Holy Days of Obligation.
But you go to Mass daily as well,
I
right?
I do now.
Yeah.
But what happened is, I always wanted to go to Mass every day. It was one of my goals. And then I read that Don Shula, he had the perfect season, and I read that he went to Mass every day. Because I always got to do it when I had time. I said, well, he hadn't got any more time than I have. And I said, So I started going to Mass every day after that. That was, what, 72, 73? And later on, when we started our football program at Ave Maria, I invited him in. He talked to our first practice.
Wow. Great. And I mean, I try to be a daily communicant as well. And I find that it's something I need. It's something that I need those graces. And I'm sure you do too, right? It's the...
Oh, yeah. If I'm traveling anywhere in the world, my staff knows where all the masses are in the area, what time they are and where they're at. And I go.
So tell me, what was your first Catholic purchase or idea or construction? Was it Legatus or?
You mean the first contribution?
Well, not necessarily the contribution, but you started Legatus, Ave Maria, and all these things. So, what was the first thing that you said? You know what? I'm going to start and organize something that's distinctly Catholic.
Well, when things started going well and they were on that track to get super well, I want to make sure that I make use of what God gave me for the best possible purpose. And to me, what's the best possible purpose? That's the easiest answer in the world. Excuse me, help people get to heaven. And the next question is, what's the best way to help people get to heaven? To me, that's also an easy answer. Help the Catholic Church. And I've been hit with every kind of request from a Catholic organization you can imagine. So I had to prioritize. So I went through a long process of figuring out what does the church need most. And I narrowed it down to education and media. And I got into some media stuff. I started the first Catholic radio station in the United States. And now we provide programming for about 300, 400 Catholic radio stations and help some others finance to get started in radio station. And then I helped EWTN, I loved Mother Angelica. But I decided that I'd do education because you could, part of education training the media. And so I did a lot of elementary schools, private elementary schools, brought in an order for nuns that started a new Dominican order, Mother Assumpta Long and Sisters of the Mary Mother of Eucharist. I got about 140 sisters now, and wow, they're teaching all over the country. And then I got involved with our high school, and I decided, well, I can build a lot of high schools, even more elementary schools, but I can only pay for so many. Somebody's got to run them. So I figured, well, maybe the most important thing I could do is start a Catholic university, because very few people can afford it. I can't even afford it, but I could get it started and then show what can be done, because I saw what was happening at Catholic higher education. It was worse than non-Catholic, and the research shows that you're better off from a faith standpoint to send your kid to a non-Catholic school than a Catholic school, with few exceptions. And I was on the board of one of those exceptions. That was Franciscan. There's only 15 Catholic schools in the country that make the Newman Guide out of 230 schools. And so I decided, well, I would continue to support Franciscan. I was their biggest benefactor. But they fired the guy that made it then. See, it was not controlled by the board. At least it's who the president is. Mm-hmm. It's the order. And so I think we needed a school that was not controlled by religious order. It was controlled by the board, and all the board members had to be devout Catholics. Our goal at Ave Maria is to be the school the devil hates the most. We want to be the school, we want to teach what the church needs the most, not try to be all things to all people. And our number one priority is vocations. We think we can produce more vocations in any school in the world, and really good vocations, like future bishops. That's making an impact. our main subject is theology. We have, that's our flagship. We have outstanding theologians. We start with Father Matthew Lamb, was many consider the best. He set up our theology department. He's no longer with us, but we want to train people to teach the faith at every level, elementary, high school, college, seminaries, universities. And we have a doctrine in theology. I think it's the best in the world. We want to stress family and marriage. In fact, we have programs about being a stay-at-home mom. That's so non-political, you can't believe it. There's no such thing as political science in higher education anymore, but we want that for Catholic home economics to train people to be mothers. And now that's going to be a lot of vocations. We want to create lawyers, ethical lawyers, judges. Someday I'd like to have somebody in the Supreme Court. Every year we're named the most conservative law school in the country. Every year we're named the most devout Catholic law school in the country. We're the only law school of the 29 Catholic law schools that made it into the Newman Guide. Know that most of them are basically woke and really mm-hmm. caved into mm-hmm. We have not. We just had a renewal of our ABA. ABA was very liberal. We're their least favorite school, and that's another accomplishment. Mm-hmm. They tried to put us out of business. So that's vocations, theology, and I would say philosophy too. Marriage and the family, and lawyers.
It's amazing goals. That's wonderful. So Ave Maria University was the first main thing that you organized and built.
In a big way. Well, yeah, I started with Agatas earlier.
Well, that's what I wanted to say.
I was a member of YPO for many years, about 10 years. It was a very beneficial organization for a young guy who's in business, a young president's organization. But they kick you out when you're 50. And I happened to be in Rome when I was 50, speaking to their big conference in Venice. And my Cardinal Detroit knew I was coming. He said that, would you like to go to Rome and while you're there in a private audience or mass with the Pope John Paul? I said, heck yes.
Right on.
My favorite person. I had my plane over there so I could make that. So I went there. I went to that mass and I was just, I'll never forget the Holy Father. His eyes met mine when he put the host on my tongue. I'll never forget that. And I'm going out of the palace, of the papal palace, and the idea occurred to me, there ought to be an organization like YPO for Catholics, but without an age limit. So right on that, I knew it was the right thing. I knew it was the Holy Spirit, and that's when I started the Agatas. It's been 38 years, about 900 and some 90-some chapters, about 2,900 members, and they meet every month. They have rosary mass, confession, cocktail session, dinner, and then a prominent speaker. And then we have a big convention every year. We have a lot of pilgrimages. So that's how the Agatas started.
If you could give advice to someone that... I guess it would have been in a similar situation as you, maybe a practicing Catholic but not devout, starting a family, has their own business, or is struggling financially. What would be like the, how would you set them straight? Like you kind of said it in this interview, but what would be like the short few sentences and paragraphs that you would share with someone about someone that's starting out?
Well, yeah, if they'd listen. I was named the entrepreneur of the decade of the 80s. I can't even spell it, and barely pronounce it. But that's, what's the definition of an entrepreneur? And I think it's, basically to have a big idea and, be willing to start small. And have some faith that you're going to work it out as you go along, not have to have everything in place.
That sounds like the definition of patience almost, right?
Yeah, there's probably some confidence that you'll figure it out as you go along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the confidence that you will figure it out, mm-hmm. find a way.
Mm-hmm. And how would you direct or share to someone the importance of their faith in bringing their faith to the family, to their workplace, to their everyday life?
Well, my logic for wanting to be a good Catholic was that if all this stuff that we're taught isn't true, it's still a happier way to live. And if you die like a mosquito and that's the end of it, you still lived a better life. But if it is true, you hit the jackpot. And someone told me that's Pascal's wager. And it makes perfect sense. And to me, if there isn't a God, nothing makes sense. If there is a God, everything makes sense.
Hey, thanks a lot for joining us for this interview. I certainly learned a lot, and I'm hoping you did too. Until next time, join us back for A Reason for Hope. Peace.